Good afternoon, and welcome to our new weekly series from Washington, D.C., that will address ongoing developments pertaining to the government's state and federal COVID-19 response. I'd like to introduce our speakers, Elizabeth Moeller, Brian Finch, and Craig Saperstein. Elizabeth Moeller serves as leader of Pillsbury's award-winning bipartisan public policy group. For more than two decades, Elizabeth has advised clients on strategies to successfully secure federal funding and tax incentives and reduce regulatory risk in Washington. Her clients include Fortune 500 companies, leading investment and advisory firms, high-growth startups, and sovereign governments. Brian Finch, a Pillsbury public policy partner, co-leads the firm's COVID-19 response team, which is providing clients with real-time legal and policy counseling on the rapidly evolving pandemic. His experience includes working with the Defense Department and HHS on a variety of emergency matters, including pandemic preparedness and response issues. He is also a visiting legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, where he is helping provide thought leadership on pandemic and security issues. Craig Saperstein, a partner within Pillsbury's public policy practice and leader of Pillsbury's state government relations practice, assists clients in developing and implementing sophisticated government relations strategies at the federal and state levels. Craig lobbies on behalf of corporate, nonprofit, foreign, sovereign, and public sector clients in Congress, the executive branch, and state and local governments. He represents clients on a variety of policy issues, including financial services, cybersecurity, international trade, energy, economic development, transportation, and healthcare matters. He also spearheads multi-state government relations campaigns for clients and trade associations who face opportunities or challenges in multiple jurisdictions. Now, I will hand it over to Craig, who will kick us off.
Thank you, Eloise. Appreciate that introduction, and thanks, everyone, for tuning in today. Definitely want to just start by saying we hope that all of you and your loved ones are staying safe and healthy and are just doing your best to cope with this very challenging situation. So please know that we send our well wishes to you. And hopefully too many folks are not being interrupted by kids or pets, et cetera, as they listen in to this conversation working from home. So we have several objectives for our conversation today. First of all, we want to make sure you have a good understanding of what Washington has done so far from a legislative perspective with respect to coronavirus. And part of that, we'll be discussing some broad details of the stimulus bill that was agreed upon last night, for which, as of 12:03 p.m. Eastern Time, we still do not have bill text for, although we do have some authoritative summaries that we can provide some details on it for you. Second, we want to share our perspective on how your company or organization can have a seat at the table in benefiting from the literally trillions of dollars that will be coming out of Washington to respond to this crisis, and Elizabeth will discuss that with you in a few minutes. And then third, we want to help you understand the interplay between decisions that are being made here at the federal level and those that are being made at the state level, and how your businesses could be affected by that interplay. And Brian will go into some detail on that later in our conversation as well. So with that, I'm going to kind of set the stage here by talking a little bit about what Congress has done so far from a legislative perspective with respect to responding to this very unique crisis. Over the past several weeks, Congress has passed three bills related to coronavirus response. The first bill, which was the smallest one that was enacted into law on March 6, provided $8.3 billion in emergency funding. Close to half of that funding was healthcare related, going to the Department of Health and Human Services. But there were some relevant provisions in that bill for folks in the business community, and really perhaps most relevant to those of you who work for or invest in small businesses or work in the nonprofit sector. The bill allowed for $1 billion in loan subsidies to be made available to help small businesses and nonprofits that have suffered losses as a result of this outbreak. As I read that provision, the bill actually doesn't establish a new SBA loan program, but it actually applies the existing loan program for disaster relief for small businesses to this ongoing pandemic. And the goal of those loan subsidies is to enable SBA to provide about $7 billion in loans to entities leveraging the $1 billion in subsidies authorized by the bill. As Elizabeth is going to talk about in a few minutes, we understand there's been very significant interest in this SBA disaster loan program, both from the small businesses themselves as well as private equity companies or other equity investors in small businesses. This program is just the start of what is a myriad of initiatives authorized by Congress that aim to prop up small businesses, particularly those that have been uniquely hit in certain industries like hospitality and so forth, as well as nonprofits that are suffering from the effects of the coronavirus in the weeks and months to come. So that was the first bill. The second bill that Congress passed last week focused largely on three issues. First, the bill focused on protecting those who are suffering from coronavirus themselves or are caring for those who are suffering from it by providing them paid leave opportunities. Second of all, the bill ensured that companies and other organizations can recoup the costs borne by providing paid leave by awarding them tax credits to offset those costs. And then third, the bill would expand some federal benefits like food stamps and some other nutrition programs for vulnerable populations like children, pregnant women and infants and others to ensure that those that are dislocated from their jobs are able to receive that nutrition or health care. I'm going to focus primarily on the leave and tax credit related provisions today, though of course we'd be pleased to talk to you individually about any of the federal benefits provisions if they're of interest to you. So with respect to paid leave, the bill authorizes two types of paid leave. The first is referred to as public health emergency leave, and it's available if an employee can't go to work because they have to care for a child who can't go to school or daycare because of the coronavirus emergency. And the law, kind of syncing with the Family and Medical Leave Act already in existence, generally provides 12 weeks of paid leave. There are some exceptions to that rule in the law. The second type of leave that the bill authorizes is referred to as emergency paid sick leave. And under the law, employers are required to provide employees with 2 weeks of paid sick leave if the employee can't work because they have or they're demonstrating symptoms associated with coronavirus, or they're prohibited from working based on government orders, such as some of these stay-at-home or shelter-in-place orders that have been issued by state and local governments, or if they're caring for someone who is actually sick with the coronavirus. So the amount that the employer is required to pay during the sick leave is determined by several factors, including whether the employee, him or herself, is sick or if they're caring for someone else. Both the public health emergency paid leave and the paid sick leave requirements will generally apply to businesses of 50 to 500 employees, and they'll both remain in effect until the end of this calendar year. So basically, you have very large businesses exempt from those requirements, businesses greater than 500 employees, as well as potential exemptions for small businesses with 50 or fewer employees from those paid leave requirements. Now, to offset the costs that employers will incur for providing those new forms of leaves, the law provides a refundable tax credit that would be paid by the employer for each quarter of 2020. And so specifically, the amount of the qualified public health leave wages taken into account for each employee is capped at $200 per day and $10,000 for all calendar quarters per employee. And then in turn, the cap per employee for sick leave wages is $511 per day. Now, there is a supplement to the amounts that businesses can receive, and that is the law increases tax credits an employer can receive to include amounts employers pay for their employees' health plan coverage, their health insurance plans, while they're on leave. If you have any questions about the new leave obligations for businesses as well as these tax credits, we have an alert on the subject that's very detailed on our Pillsbury website, and we'd also be happy to connect you with our tax and employee benefits attorneys who know these provisions in and out and have been studying them very carefully. So that gets us to the third bill, the big kahuna, if you will, of stimulus measures that Congress is considering. And again, an agreement was reached on that bill last night around 1:30 in the morning. I stayed up till about 11:30 waiting for it and then called it a night. But as of the start of this call, I had not seen bill text, and I've been scouring the internet and talking to my sources. However, again, we have seen some summaries of this legislation. So we're going to just provide some broad outlines of what this third nearly $2 trillion bill has in it. And then, of course, we can supplement that with you individually and as well as on our call next week. So, you know, first of all, the bill does include this large $500 billion fund for businesses that are impacted by the pandemic. Some of those funds go to specific industries. Some of those funds go to different categories of businesses. Probably the one that's gotten the most attention is the $50 billion for the airline industry. We understand, and again, we haven't seen the bill text, but we understand that provision has actually evolved over the last few days and that the airline industry may actually be receiving grants and the federal government could actually take a stake in the airlines rather than a loan or a loan guarantee as had been previously discussed. But it will be approximately $50 billion for the airlines to recover from this crisis. There's also a lot of new money for small businesses in this new bill. The bill authorizes $350 billion worth of 100% guaranteed SBA loans, a portion of which SBA will forgive based on allowable expenses for the borrower. And the package also includes $10 billion in direct grants for businesses. So there's also funding for state and local governments, $150 billion in total, $25 billion for emergency transit funding. And then, of course, there's provisions for individuals who are, suffering. Of course, there are $1,200 per person recovery rebates provided. That's a check for everyone, as well as $500 per child, and a huge increase in unemployment insurance payments, full compensation for 4 months in particular. And that was something that was really pressed hard by Senate Democrats in negotiating this bill. So I'm going to leave it there since that is what we have at this stage. But again, we're going to have many more details about this large stimulus bill in the days to come, and we look forward to speaking to you about it next week and of course, in between with any of you individually. And now I'm going to turn it to Elizabeth, who's going to talk a little bit about how businesses and other organizations can actually develop a strategy for accessing these funds going forward now that they're available.
I'll start, of course, by talking with about what you should be doing if you're interested in securing stimulus funding and you're an industry involved in managing or treating the virus. There are different opportunities. And if you're an industry that's been impacted and faces economic distress, there are different opportunities. And so we're trying on, our team is taking a very broad approach, looking, I call it beyond SBA, SBA and beyond, to find out where there are other sort of untapped and unknown opportunities for big dollar funding. On that note, I think we all share the same goal. The public goal is clear. We want efficient and effective distribution of federal funding. We want to stop the virus, and we want to save the economy. And for those of you on the phone from the federal government, we want to say thank you for taking this responsibility to heart. Winners are going to win in the federal application process. And that's because a smart approach will combine compliance, making sure you're abiding by all ethics and political laws and regulations, and by combining it with government contracting. A sophisticated approach to every possible vehicle that can be used to distribute funds at the local, state, and federal levels. We love things like cooperative agreements. We love public-private partnerships. We love anything that shows a sophisticated track record of success. That's what we want to see. That is because we know that at some point there will be oversight. there will be more funding and there will be oversight. And that will come both from the agencies and the inspector generals, and it will come from Congress. So what do you do next then if you're trying to get in the game for funding at this sort of case-by-case basis? Our approach, first of all, is to get as much information as we can from personal contacts. And as the leader of our team, I'm happy to be an ambassador for a global group that has a vast political network at the local, state, federal, and international levels, which makes it really fun to think about big picture problems and solving them. And it makes it really fun to think about playing offense on the federal funding front as well. Right now, we are facing a unique political landscape in that everyone is displaced, and that includes the federal employees who will be, tasked with making sure the funds are distributed properly. It's a challenge of bandwidth for people, and we've heard a challenge for bandwidth literally with our communications network. That makes it all the more important to have uber-connectedness, and I'd love to ask my colleague Brian Finch to chime in. I know you work closely with the administration. What are you seeing on that front from the personnel and the challenges there?
Thanks, Elizabeth, and I also repeat my best wishes to everybody during this fairly stressful time. So, yes, we are seeing bandwidth challenges, as you say, both human and technical. And make the following comment, apolitical as possible. We know that the Trump administration has already had some limited issues with respect to personnel shortages and due to a variety of reasons, but there are a number of unfilled positions in the Trump administration right now. There's obviously lots of acting secretaries, assistant secretaries, political appointments that have gone unfilled, et cetera, retirements that have gone unfilled as well. So there is a shortage in a number of offices right now of key personnel. And you add into that the technical issues that have been striking the various cabinet agencies recently. We saw just with the first weekend of teleworking, it was overwhelming Defense Department networks and even included a spike in cyber attacks as well. So it is a bit challenging in that regard, and there are still federal employees who are going to work on a daily basis. The federal government is probably the original entity to use the term essential employee, and as one person told me back in the 70s, they went to work and they were very crestfallen to find out that they were not, in fact, essential during a snow day. And that's usually what it meant for employees in Washington, federal government employees. It was the difference between getting to stay home or going to work when a couple inches of snow had fallen in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. But the essential employees are working. It's just an overwhelming crush of work right now. And so that is more than likely to slow down a little bit of what's going on in terms of the response and the deployment of the stimulus, which I'll talk about in a few seconds. But I'll turn it back over to Elizabeth to allow her to finish her remarks.
Great. Thank you. And it's really interesting and exciting to see then what is your strategy, given that those facts. And, of course, it's to get your facts together and to be able to tell your story if you're trying to sell a product to the federal government or a state or local government. And if you're economically distressed, it's a chance to evaluate the tax landscape, the loan guarantee landscape, and your own personal story about how you're impacted. So let's talk a little bit about the SBA and then the other agencies that are kind of exciting ones to watch. On the SBA front, they've seen unprecedented demand, and the website is down. It crashed. That, to me, is a great narrative about what is happening now in Washington. Our team has found that WhatsApp and text and Signal are other preferred ways of communication so we can stay in touch with people throughout the world. But to me, that's a great story. It does, our government contracting team will be sharing alerts on this subject because we've seen such demand. It is a great chance to get into the game because it's so broadly written, and you can get a lot of funding from it. So we think it's terrific. There isn't, we haven't seen the text, but we haven't seen a lot of guidance about the $10 billion for direct grants, but that seems to be the best way to go. We always like direct federal funding whenever possible. So certainly be on the lookout for additional details once we have the final text. Having a government contracting approach is really smart, too, because it makes it as easy as possible to streamline your application, thinking about it the way that a government contracting lawyer should. The other, looking beyond SBA and taking a creative approach to what the bill, the final bill, is likely to include, we are really excited about the Department of Commerce and the $1.5 billion designated for the Economic Development Administration. For our friends on the call from local governments, now is your opportunity. This is disaster assistance funding, and it's economic assistance. And if you have a public-private partnership, oh, say an opportunity zone, this is a great chance to make a strong case that you should recover through some of those EDA funds. It also applies if you're in the tourism business or the manufacturing business. So not a lot of people know about this, and it's a very small group that runs the EDA, but one to watch at the Department of Commerce. We were also interested to note that the Department of Justice will also be distributing funding. There will be a lot of law enforcement, loans and grants. The grants can be used for a variety of purposes. It's $850 million to the states. So that's one where if you're in the medical supply business or testing business, lots of opportunities there with law enforcement. And they can also use those funds to purchase additional equipment. We look then to, what about the Department of Education? I really want to start a distance learning program immediately when I see that there should be about $30 billion with a B dollars for an education program administered through the Department of Education. And that will be used for almost anything related to online learning. It goes to states and to local school districts. So exciting opportunities there we see. And then what you're saying to yourself, what about the Department of Veterans Affairs? Interesting to note, $15.8 billion dedicated to equipment and telemedicine. So again, if you're in any of those businesses, it's great to take a cross-sectional view of where the government is funding things. With that, I'm happy to turn it over to Brian, since I know we're limited on time. But we see this landscape as very exciting, dynamic, and there will be a stimulus for, Craig, maybe we'll be writing a client alert on that pretty soon ourselves, too. But, Brian, I'd love to turn it over to you for your view on the critical infrastructure issues.
Thanks, Elizabeth. So you're absolutely right in identifying critical infrastructure. Really, I think the issue that we have been crushed with over the past week or so is determining how to understand and interpret and comply by with the various critical infrastructure and essential alerts that have gone out. And by that, I mean the various shelter-in-place orders in New York, California, Maryland, Maryland, Massachusetts, and lots of other jurisdictions, both state and local, defining who is an essential worker, who is a critical business, who gets to stay open, and who needs to make sure that they are shuttered until the pandemic passes. It's an illustrative example of the difficulty in responding to the pandemic right now for a number of reasons. Number one, the federal government actually doesn't have authority to order the states, tell them who is an essential worker, who is a critical business, et cetera. There's some very limited exceptions to that with the defense industrial base, but for the most part, these are orders that are really left up to mayors, governors, city council, county administrators, et cetera. And so it's been challenging. We've had lots of issues working with companies and our clients and new clients, trying to help them understand, where do they fit within these orders? Are their employees actually essential? Can they continue to conduct business, et cetera? And I raise that not to talk about what we've been working over the past week or so, but more about the challenges that are associated with what the federal government can do and how it can implement that. And you're about to see that exponentially increased in terms of its difficulty and challenges with respect to the disbursement of the stimulus funds. And it's why early engagement with the executive branch and to the legislative branch is going to be absolutely critical. As Craig mentioned earlier, we just got a summary of the Senate stimulus bill. And in looking through it, the one area that really leapt out to me was that of all the agencies and subcomponents who are getting funding, and there's, you know, a billion here, 10 billion there, et cetera, the one that leapt out to me was this. Within the Health and Human Services Department, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response was just appropriated $127 billion. $127 billion. That's more than any other agency that we have seen in any outside of the checks that are to go to individuals. $127 billion to the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. That's an extraordinary sum of money for a subcomponent of Health and Human Services that I guarantee most people have not heard of. And in particular, what's interesting is that $127 billion, $100 billion is going for a new federal program to provide grants to hospitals, public entities, et cetera, to help them cover unreimbursed healthcare-related expenses or lost revenues attributable to the coronavirus. Many of you may not have yet dealt with ASPR, and especially those of you who are not in the public emergency, health emergency world. It is a small office. Bob Kadlec, who runs it, is a former staff director on the Senate side. He's a very smart man, retired armed forces. But $100 billion suddenly going to him. Keep in mind that FEMA had hundreds of people on an annual basis to administer about $4 billion in grants that were going out to states. Now you've got this small office whose biggest job over the past 15 years was to spend $6 billion, $6 billion with a B, on vaccines and treatments for various bio and chemical threats, and it took them 10 years to spend $6 billion. Now all of a sudden they're getting $127 billion. It's a great example of how this money is going through a funnel. It's going to start wide, but actually getting it out to these entities is going to prove very challenging. And so you're going to need to have the contacts right away in these various agencies throughout the federal government to know that you can contact them, start having communications with them, lining up your congressional support to make sure that that money goes out, and also being prepared for the inevitable investigation that is going to come. Remember that similar amounts of money were spent on Afghanistan over the last 20 years. And what's one of the first things that the federal government and the military had to do was set up an entire inspector general wing to oversee the money and determine whether it was being properly spent. That group, which was supposed to be temporary 20 years later, still going. And so you need to be prepared for that. And as you think about what you need to do to gain access to some of this money, whether it's in Health and Human Services, education, commerce, labor, agriculture, wherever it is, make sure that you are prepared to reach out to these agencies and also be prepared to do some very exact bookkeeping in order to ensure that you don't get stuck into a very long and expensive investigation afterwards. So I know we're approaching the end of the half an hour. This is obviously a short briefing today since it's breaking news, but we are going to have more to come. This is going to be a weekly series. And we are also all obviously available for individual questions. And with that, I'll turn it back to Eloise to help us wrap up for today.
Thank you, Brian, Elizabeth, and Craig. And thank you to our attendees for joining our webinar. If you have any questions, please reach out to a member of our public policy team or one of our presenters. We look forward to hosting you again on our next Washington Weekly briefing, and we'll be sharing the recording in a two-short question survey within 24 hours. Have a wonderful afternoon.